Anike Reel 2. So you were telling me what you fired.
We fired ballistate cartridge with a rocket in the top of the like a natural firework rocket out the barrel with a ballistate cartridge.
And what was this fusillade called?
It's a follow-on. The first one fires, and then they all fire in succession around the squares, and it goes up, and it actually ends up in the fireworks in a big cascade all the way around. The only thing was, when all the bits comes up and down, there was burning holes in our caps.
And you had to pay for that?
No.
So, how long did you stay in England for?
We stayed in England until the 18th of September. And then the battalion, we went from Aldershot to the government sardines, and we went down to, on the 18th of September, we went down to Southampton, and we went across to France on a ship called the Maid of Orleans, across Channel Ferry.
In September 39?
Yeah. When I wasn't even 18. I was going to be, 39. I won't be 18 well, the end of November. So basically, according to the army, I was 17.
What do you remember about crossing to France?
Oh, it was uneventful, really. We landed at Cherbourg, on the mall at Cherbourg. And then we marched from the mall at Cherbourg, the battalion, to the terminal where the Queen Mary used to tie up and pick up passengers at Cherbourg on the way to America. It used to tie up in Cherbourg, and the other terminal there where all the passengers boarded the Queen Mary.
What happened there?
And then we stopped there the night, and then we went up to a place called Le Mans. And we was at Le Mans, maybe 5 or 6 days, and then the next thing was on the in the cattle trucks, and we went up to Arras, you know what I mean, stage by stage, until we ended up at a place called Bachy on the Belgian frontier.
Bachy?
B-A-C-H-Y. It was only a little place, but it was on the Belgian frontier.
What happened to you there?
Oh, well, while I was there, this is going to be a twist to the story. When I was there, as I told you, my father always said, "I will never get you out," right? When I enlisted in the army, he said, "Don't ever ask me to get you out, you know, being underage and what have you." So what happened was I was out, was digging fortifications, and then they said, "Oh, you wanted at the company office." So I trotted down to the company office back. When I got there, the sergeant major was there, and he was looking at me a bit stern-like. I thought, "Oh, what have I done?" And yeah, we marched me in there, as the company commander sat there, and the first thing he said to me was, "How old are you?" I thought, "Hello, this is it." And I said, 20. And the officer said, "Don't tell bloody lies, you're not. You're 17. He said. And then he gave me all the rigmarole about that I could be jailed and that for enlisting under a false representation. Anyhow, he said, you'll be going back to England. And that was it. Next thing was, I was given a warrant, put on a train at Arras, went to the station at Arras, put on a train and straight to Cherbourg.
How had they found out?
What had happened, my father, he wouldn't get me out. And what happened was, several people who knew the family, our family, knew where I was. And they sort of, my father said, oh, I'm not getting him out, he enlisted, so he's going to see it out. But different people were sort of looking down on him but for not doing something. Said, you should, being in the First World War yourself, and being a prisoner of war for 2 years in 1916, they said, you know what it's like, why do you, when you can get him back in England, when he's not allowed to, shouldn't be out there, why don't you get him back? If anything happens to him, it's your fault. They was holding him responsible if anything happened to me. Anyway, that was the end of it. I ended up having to come back.
How did you feel about that?
Oh, I was browned off. I didn't go a lot on it. I didn't want to come back.
Why not?
I was all right where I was.
So where did they send you back to?
Pairbright.
To do what?
I went back to the Pairbright where all the there was all the recruits were being trained and what have you, and the number of men like a holding battalion where they sent reinforcements from Pairbright. What they call a holding battalion, with the proviso that I wouldn't be allowed to go abroad till I was 19, because that was the statute. That's what it was then. 19, nobody was allowed abroad unless they were 19, unless you was like me and you fiddled your way through it.
How did you like being at this holding battalion?
Oh, I didn't go a lot on it, but eventually it did materialise a bit better, because we moved from there to eventually we moved to Regent's Park Barracks, and it was purely no recruit training there, purely reinforcing battalion for sending men abroad.
Is that when you were doing the guards outside Buckingham Palace?
Yeah. And also during the Blitz, we did a lot of things that a lot of people don't know about. What we did, we went out when the threat of an invasion when there was a threat of invasion, we also have to turn out before light in the morning and spread out through Regent's Park to stop any parachutes that would land. We used to go before light in the morning, all the riflemen out the barracks, and spread through Regent's Park to stop any landing of parachutes there. And then as the morning went, as it got later and later and there was nothing happening, we went back to barracks and carried on with our normal duties. We also used to go around in police cars with the police from every station in London that had police cars. We used to go two to a car and go around with the police during the night. As an escort for the police, like, in case of anybody parachuting in or anything like that. And We just Saturday did all the shift, and then next morning we were gathered up and took back to barracks from the different police stations. And we did that for quite a while.
Did any bombs fall near Regent's Park Barracks?
Yeah. Yeah.
Was it hit?
Yeah, one dropped. It was funny, this. I used to go, there was a course of communal laboratory, you know what I mean, in the army. And usually on the dinner time, after I'd had my dinner, I used to go in these laboratories without fail. And this day, my pal said to me, he said, oh, I said, come on, well, let's go in the naffy, there's nobody in there, we'll get served quick. So I didn't go in. A lone plane came over and dropped a bomb, and it dropped it on the laboratory and killed one man in the barracks. And the laboratory is practically next door to the naffy. It just killed the one man. Another day I'd have been in there.
Any other memories of the bombing of London?
Oh, yeah. The thing is, the bombs were there every night. Every night. And it was non-stop. But the thing was, the tube stations were full of Londoners sleeping in them. And of course, when we went out on a night, when we went on the tube, we didn't have to pay. We just had to walk down, and nobody paid on the tube. We didn't. There was nobody taking any money, because they couldn't stop all the public going down to sleep down there. So we more or less, when we went out on a night, we travelled on the tube free. And also, I spent quite a number of times taking German prisoners from London up to the, on train, up to a big mill in Oldham. We used to take them from London, from where they'd been interrogated. I think it was one of the palaces in London, minor palaces, but we never got to there. We just picked them up like, and took them on the railway, in the railway, on the normal railway. And there was U-boat men, airmen, and we'd maybe take 30 at a time on the train.
What was their attitude?
Oh, they were very arrogant. They were arrogant people. Arrogant. Very. Even then, in the late 1940, they were confident that they was winning the war, and that they would be released out of the prison camps in England by the Germans. They were convinced of that.
So how did you treat them?
Well, you had to treat them in a proper manner. You weren't allowed to do any other. But, well, what happened was, the two guardsmen used to be in the old coach. There was the old coaches where you have 8 seats, 4 either side, and two guardsmen stood at the door of each one. But there was two intelligence men dressed same as us, who used to relieve us. Keep relieving, but they were dressed same as us, like. But they weren't our people, they were German-speaking troops, and they listened to what the Germans were talking about. And I do believe, but I ain't sure about this, no, we heard that one of these interpreters who'd been listening to them, he was listening and he found out something that the British government didn't know about, and that was the fact that before the war, they had a big pocket battleship called the Deutschland, and unknown to the government here, or the intelligence here, they changed its name to the Admiral Scheer. They changed its name to the Admiral Scheer. And, of course, the intelligence here thought that got another pocket battleship apart from the Deutschland, but it was the same ship. And we heard say that on one of them journeys, one of them interpreters heard that. Whether he did or not, I don't know, but that was the story.
Did any of them cause any trouble?
No, they didn't cause no trouble. But the most trouble we had was when we took when all the aliens were interned, and they brought about 600 or 700 of them to the Regent's Park Barracks into the riding school there, and we had to take them to. We took them in buses from Regent's Park Barracks to Waterloo Station, I believe it was Waterloo, and we took them to Kempton Park Racecourse. And handed them over there, Kempton, and they were kept on the racecourse at Kempton Park. But when we got to Waterloo Station, some of them was got a bit arrogant and refused to get on the train. There was mainly Italians that had been living in London for a long while and thought that they shouldn't have been interned. But two or three of them was laid on the ground, wouldn't get up, and of course the officer just said, get hold of them and throw them on. But they thought that because they'd lived in London a number of years, that they shouldn't have been interned. And they laid down on the platform, but didn't make no difference. They just picked them up and threw them in.
Did you do that yourself?
No. People within distance of me, like out of my same platoon, like they did, but they was the nearest to them. If I'd have been near to them, I'd have had to have done it. But it was silly of them doing it, because they should have known at the end of the day they was going to get on. There was no way they weren't going to get on.
Any other memories of being in England?
Yeah. I remember taking 40 British Union and fascists from Brixton Prison to York Racecourse. And they were a very sullen lot there, were very quiet. And we took them from Brixton Prison to York Racecourse. And when we got to York Racecourse, I was amazed. There were hundreds of people all interned in York. And they all had uniforms. They'd all made themselves uniforms, like Italians. All made uniforms. And the place was full of them, York Racecourse. Anyway, we handed these British Union of Fascists over. There'd be about 40 of them, I think, single-decker bus full. And we went on the train with them to York, and then from York to the racecourse, and handed them over at York Racecourse.
How were they behaving?
Oh, very quiet. Never spoke. They never questioned anything. They just did not speak. And it was, well, you know, people sort of saying, there's army officers among them, and there's naval officers, and there's this, that and the other, but there was no one in uniform. They're all in civilian clothes, so you didn't know what there was. But they were very subdued and never caused any trouble whatsoever. Just went along, did as they were told, and into York Racecourse. But that was what surprised me when we got there. There were maybe 300 or 400 on York Racecourse, and they're all in these uniforms, had made up themselves, more like Italian hats and all that business. And of course, the soaps give them a round of language when they went by, like.
Who did?
The soldiers, or we did. Give them a few words when we went by, because they was looking through the wire.
What type of things were you saying?
Well, best place for you. If I, someone else saying, if I had my way, I'd shoot you. So the usual banter that would go on between people like that.
Did they respond to it?
Oh, a lot of jeering, and they were saying, oh, we'll be alive at the end of the war, you won't. We'll be alive at the end of the war, you won't. So that was the British Union of Fascists. And we helped to escort quite a number of prisoners from London to Oldham. We always took them to Oldham. In Lancashire.
Who were these, internees?
Prisoners of war. Airmen shot down, U-boat men that had been brought to the surface. We used to take about 24 or 5 at a time. After they'd been in the interrogation, when they'd finished with them.
Any other memories of being in England before you went abroad?
Only, you're talking about, like, later on in the war, like, 1940.
Yes.
Well, from the holding battalion, a new battalion was being formed. And I was fed up being at this holding battalion. I wanted to be in a proper battalion, I'd always been in. And I went to the 5th Battalion, which was formed as a part of the Guards Armoured Division. The 5th Battalion Coldstream Guards. They were formed as part of what was going to be the new Guards Division, but it was going to be Armoured Division, the Guards Armoured Division. And we formed at Elstree. The battalion was formed at Elstree. In 1941. But also, while I was at Regent's Park, we did a lot of guarding at Chequers as Prime Minister. We did quite a bit of that at Chequers.
What do you remember about that?
Oh, it was a pretty nice place for us to get. We used to do about, I think it was about 2 or 3 months at a time there. Each company took it in turns. And we used to go there to, it was Chequers. It was a little village outside Aylesbury, actually. And but we was in a camp outside the Chequers house in the grounds. And we guarded that, but it was well guarded. And at night time, if you was in the Rose Garden, as they called it, if you was in the Rose Garden, well, Winston Churchill used to sleep in the bedroom above the Rose Garden. You was underneath. And when there was a lot of aeroplanes going over, he always used to poke his head out the window about 1 or 2 in the morning and ask what he thought about the bombing and one thing or another. Oh, he used to be asking about what was going on, like, if he happened to be in that on that sentry post.
Did he ever speak to you?
Yeah, I spoke to him.
What did you say to him?
He asked me if I could had any idea how many bombers had gone over. And I was surprised at that. I'd have thought he'd want to have asked a question like that.
Did you know?
I didn't know. All we could say, well, there seems to be hundreds going over, according to the engines. But he was concerned, there was no doubt about that. Very concerned. And we used to see all the celebrities come. All the chiefs of staff, like de Gaulle and people like that, they all used to come, and we used to have to check them at the gate. We had a list of all people that were expected to go to that front gate to go to the house. He had a list. And the orders were, if anybody wasn't on that list, didn't matter who there was, even if you thought you recognised them, if they weren't on that list, they did not go through them gates. And we only had one. While I was there, there was only one bit of trouble, and that was with General Roosevelt. He was in the American Army. And I wasn't on sentry at the time, but he came down, and two of the lads on sentry, he said, open the gates, you know what I mean? Well, the gates were open, used to be open, but... they stopped him, said, no, you don't go through there. And he said, if your name's not on the list, you don't go through. And he was there with another car full of Americans. And they wouldn't let him through anyway. He sort of threatened to force his way through. And of course, he was told in no uncertain terms that if he did, he would be shot. He was going to be the first one to be shot. So then he had second thoughts about it. And of course, by then, our company commander had come on the scene. And they'd got the Churchill's bodyguard, Inspector Thompson. He appeared on the scene. And it was all smoothed over, but he thought he could just, because he said his name was General Roosevelt, he could walk in. And later, I read where he was at the Battle of the Beach at Omaha. He was on a warship off the beach, and he wanted to go in with the troops, and they wouldn't allow him. They said, no, the general don't go leading the front of the troops these days. He was supposed to want to go. His name was Roosevelt, but what his first name was, I don't know whether it wasn't Theodore, like his grandfather or not. But he thought he was going to barge his way through.
Any other memories of Checkers?
No, not really, only that when the Prime Minister was there on a weekend, it was well guarded, there was plenty of troops round him, and on top of that there was plenty of AK-AT guns. It was well guarded, and there was a barbed wire apron fence round the whole of the house, and it would have been about 12 feet wide. About 12 feet wide, and double apron fences, you know, the stakes to put in for the barbed wire, with a coil on them. Seen them in the First World War that stuck up with the barbed wire on them. Do you understand what I mean? With them, and it was about 12 feet wide. There was about three double apron fences. It must have been 12 feet wide. One mass of barbed wire